Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so this evening is the full moon, and quite special because it has the eclipse of the moon that still happening, and so that quite beautiful, really. You know, we follow these cycles, and in our life, following the lunar calendar, lunar cycles, and seeing, and you think, well, it's always going to follow a pattern. It's always going to be like this, and then there's an eclipse. And you think, well, that's different. But as you see that even in the cycles of nature, that theme of that Ajahn Chah would always put forward of not sure. There's always some kind of uncertainty in the system. There's always some change taking place that oftentimes we don't account for, or the things that are not quite the pattern that we assumed it was going to be. So those are, you know, this is something that is worthy of contemplation and reflection, because we assume things are going to be a certain way because that's how we've seen it happen, or we assume some sort of control over something, and it's going to happen a certain way because I want it to happen that way. That's that illusion of control. The way of the Buddha's teachings and the way of Dhamma is always being willing to take into account uncertainty, impermanence, change, inconstancy, and that's a helpful perspective that allows us to take into account the true nature of things, or the way things actually are when they manifest, whether we are prepared for it or not. Things are going to happen in the way they will. It's like I was talking last night, then that this is the way things are. It's like this. Being able to have the presence of mind, agility of mind, and I think this is one of the things that we're cultivating, or need to cultivate, is an agility of mind that is able to adapt and accept things as they are. And of course, the ways that we cultivate this agility of mind, and you know, there really it's the whole Buddha's path, but when we're teaching, we pick out little odds and here ends here and there in order to highlight certain aspects. And I think certainly an aspect that is important is an aspect of humility. Let's see, one of the downfalls of the within Greek mythology, one of the is hubris, and the gods would get into trouble with whenever they got caught in hubris, that sort of overestimation, over cherishing of oneself, and so the sense of humility is really essential, not in terms of I'm going to grind my sense of self down and not let it manifest, but it's more having the agility of mind to see the difficulty that's created when in the Tibetan tradition they use the word self-cherishing, and that's a really nice turn of phrase, in that sense of that self-cherishing, because it can cut both ways in terms of either self-cherishing in the sense of propping oneself up, puffing oneself up, or self-cherishing in the sense of even putting oneself down or trying to diminish that sense of self, because it still comes from a self-cherishing, and humility is a sense of I think that where there's a natural sense of appreciation both of one's own potential as well as the potential of others. So there's a kindness that's there, and a compassion that's there, and that's a really essential component. That again, the sense of agility, which helps to implement and actualize humility, compassion. So a story that comes to mind, or an example that comes to mind, is the story. There's a story from the Dhammapada commentary of the Buddha, as was his wont, he recognized that there was a poor farmer in a nearby village. He was living in Savatthi, and it was quite a ways away, but the Buddha would, this is, say, the Buddha's duty, or what he used to do, is to survey the world and see who was ripe to understand the Dhamma, to receive his teachings. And he said, there's this poor farmer who lived, it was a couple hours' walk away, it wasn't close by. So that the Buddha walked there, and the villagers gathered, and Buddha was going to give a teaching. And this poor farmer had faith in the Buddha and had devotion, but he had just as he had heard of that the Buddha was going to be giving a teaching, his cow ran off, and he had to go and track down his cow and get his cow, and he was late for the teaching, and it was getting late in the day as well. And when he and the Buddha was waiting, actually, for this poor farmer to arrive at the gathering place. And everybody's kind of wondering what the heck is going on. And because they're waiting patiently, knowing that the Buddha was going to teach, but then they're... And then this poor farmer showed up. He was late. And he'd been out chasing his cow, and he was tired and hungry. And the Buddha told the lay people to find some food for him and feed him, so that he his hunger was and tiredness was dealt with. And they did, and then he listened to the. He was refreshed by by the meal and eating and some nourishment. Listened to the Dhamma, and as these stories go, he attained stream entry, but after people are sort of, wow, that was really weird. What's there's either criticizing or confused by the Buddha, one waiting for this person, and then also asking to feed him, and of course Ananda heard the criticisms and asked the Buddha what was that all about, and the Buddha said, well, that poor farmer I realized that he had the capacity to be awakened to the Dhamma, but because he'd been out working and chasing his cow, he was tired and hungry, and that feeling of oppression and tiredness and hunger would have been an obstacle to his understanding the Dhamma. And he said, somebody who is feeling oppressed like that is rarely capable of being able to penetrate the Dhamma. There's a certain ease that's needed, and certain level of, not so much comfort, but maybe comfort, ease, well-being, for the mind to really settle. So that this sense of the Buddha being incredibly compassionate, and certainly there's a humility that the Buddha displaying in really caring for the different needs of people, and that of course that's as an archetype, those are the it's an example for us to be attentive to, say, looking after ourselves, looking after others, having that humility and compassion. Because it's easy to have kind of ideals of what we should be, what others should be, what standards they have to comply with, the bar they have to come up to. But sometimes that comes from a certain harshness of outlook, or it's not and you know, very strong opinion, very strong view, and it's not there's not really that much humility there. There's a certain hubris of either myself or others or the world has to comply to my standard, and or we we measure ourselves in different ways. I came across this kind of news, sort of a news article, where because in South Korea, where and this is an example of let's say, like measuring one's say self-worth or one's success or acceptability in by one's performance. Say one has to perform up to a certain standard, and they're sort of after this is this these are school children or high school students or or younger, but the this sense of kind of drivenness, really, that the after school tutoring programs to try to boost the students' ability to excel on the tests and the exams, and these after school programs are going on like on a daily basis till after midnight, students constantly driving themselves because their measure of their worth or their worry of not succeeding is just keeping them, they go to school the whole day and then go to the after school tutoring programs. And anyway, the government, the reason why I've read it is because it was this kind of the government had to step in and mandate or legislate that these after-school programs can't go later than 10 o'clock at night. And you think, and you figure, to my sense, I mean, 10 o'clock at night is already, I mean, school's enough already. but to, so that, that but there's a, that sense of trying, having to have an external measure for oneself, and that geared to the success at a particular thing or coming up to a particular standard that one sets, and of course it's from the Buddhist teachings. Of course, that this is, these are driven by desire, and desire is never quenchable. You can't really quench the desire to excel, especially when it comes from a feeling of lack. So there's a humility is also a sense of from a Buddhist sense, there's a sense of ease and well-being that one's sense of self is grounded in in Dhamma or in principles of Dhamma, where the ability to experience well-being that's grounded in, say, in wholesome actions, generosity, virtue, loving kindness, and that one sense of well-being is ground, and one sense maybe of self-compassion has that foundation. So that this sense of cultivation of an agility of mind as we practice the Dhamma, and to reflecting back on the extremes that the Buddha points to in his very first discourse, the extreme of sensual or sensory indulgence and self-mortification. Those qualities are those tendencies, those extremes that the mind goes to are always going to end in suffering. And it's that sense of constant seeking of gratification, of pleasure, of affirmation, of a well-being that's predicated on external conditions, it's never really going to hit the mark. And then the other extreme of self-mortification, in the sense of that creating, say, difficulty for oneself, suffering for oneself, that somehow it will end in. That there's some nobility that arises out of suffering or being miserable somehow is inherently good for one. I think that's there can be that assumption sometimes that one's having a real difficult time, one's really suffering. It's really difficult. And that somehow there's some redemptive power in things being miserable. It's not really true. There isn't an inherent redemptive power to it. It's sometimes things just suck sometimes. It doesn't necessarily create any nobility whatsoever. In fact, it's sort of, you can be perpetuating difficulty. So this sense of agility and being able to recognize a balance and find a balance in one's approach to our cultivation of our search for a spiritual answer, and this is one of the things that the Buddha points to as his word as the noble search, seeking for a way out of suffering, seeking for a way out of the complications that that the human condition keep coming up with, and that search is grounded in these simple principles of that we can train ourselves in body, speech, and mind in that which is wholesome and skillful and conducive to happiness and well-being, and it leads to a freedom from suffering, or it can lead. But as I say, that this finding a balance of, say, you know, not getting caught by that the extremes that the mind goes to, that our life goes to, both in terms of, say, the classical, say, the kamasukala kama yoga, that sensual indulgence, atta kila matana yoga, the self-mortification. But that has so many permutations, and it goes into the aspects of belief and view, in the sense of the kind of the way the mind goes to propping up a sense of being and becoming and getting and achieving, or the pushing away, the annihilating, the negation. So those extremes of affirmation, negation, those are structures of view, structures of opinion, and they lead us to a place of imbalance. And so there's a sense of, again, a sense of agility, where we're able to see what the push behind, what the kind of the motivation behind, what are we trying to get out of something? What are we trying to be? What are we trying to become? What are we trying to get rid of? And to come back to this simple quality of seeing clearly. That is, again, something that I mentioned last night, that knowledge and vision are the way things truly are. And seeing things in their true nature, seeing things in that sense of, okay, this is really driven by desire. There's some attachment going there. Or there's some noble search behind that. There's a noble aspiration behind that that needs to be nurtured, needs to be encouraged, so that we're able to reflect and investigate and put our attention onto those qualities that allow a clarity to establish itself. Like today is the Buddhist bicycle pilgrimage. People arrived today and ended it here. And the theme that was used through the whole pilgrimage was contentment and gratitude. And those are qualities that are really essential components of spiritual practice. Well, actually, it's a sane life, but in terms of spiritual practice, to be able to turn our attention to the quality of contentment. Because we are driven by dissatisfaction, We're either dissatisfied with the external world, dissatisfied with the internal world, dissatisfied with ourselves. We never quite measure up to the ways that we think, or the world never quite measures. But to be able to have a sense of contentment, you realize, okay, things are like, it's like this. How can I be content with this? Which doesn't mean one doesn't do anything. But that foundation of contentment is important in order to make skillful choices of where we're going to put our effort and energy. And this is something that is oftentimes not really understood well in the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha makes a lot of that quality of contentment, but he also makes a lot of that the necessity for effort. And oftentimes our effort is either it's unskillfully directed, or it's we're kind of flailing around just doing something because we're not very clear. But that quality of having attention to the quality of contentment allows us to see more clearly, where do I put my effort? Where do I put forth energy? How do I apply myself within this situation or in this circumstance, or given the particular configuration of my mind and my personality, where is that most effective? How can I put forth effort? So that contentment, we're not just reacting to either habitual tendencies or particular fears or obsessions that we have of the moment, but there's a steadiness that arises because of contentment. We can be content, we can be satisfied with the particular circumstance of the moment. And that, I think in the human condition in general, and it's pretty rare, but I think modern society is the amount of advertising that we get, the amount of imagery that we get, the amount of information that we get, keeps the mind stirred up and dissatisfied. That's when it's important to make a very conscious attention toward the quality of contentment. And similarly, gratitude. That there's that dissatisfaction that is so much a part of modern society, modern culture, and there's not much, there's not many advertising campaigns that emphasize gratitude, so that it's something that we need to bring up very consciously, very overtly, and then you realize, of course, there's huge areas of our whole life is informed by things that are really worthy of gratitude. That we live, incredibly comfortable lives for the most part. There's always something. I mean, there's certainly always something to complain about if you want to, but there's always something that's never quite as good as it could be. But if we keep our attention focused on what we can keep our whinging going with, it does make the heart very bright or very beautiful. Whereas really making a conscious effort of recognizing those areas where, and those circumstances and those people towards which we're recipients of some goodness in some way, and it's worthy of having gratitude. That brightens the mind, and that's it's an essential quality of spiritual practice, and for the mind to truly become peaceful, so that it's only when there's this sense of settledness and stability that we can understand the true nature of things and kind of weave our way through this, say, the reality of being in the human condition that's fraught with dukkha, with suffering. And it's a permanent condition in the sense that it's always going to be there, but we have to see it clearly. The tools that the Buddha gives us are sufficient to do the job. Mm-hmm. So these are some ramblings after a long weekend of things happening in the monastery, and it ain't over yet. So I'll offer that for your reflection.